Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening this morning. We have another candidate with us this morning on the program here on Focus for a long time. We've tried to give you the opportunity to have a little bit of direct contact with candidates. We reporters and media people get to talk with them all the time, but we'd like to make these opportunities so that potential voters can also talk with candidates. And many of them have agreed and been very gracious to come and spend time with us this morning to talk and answer questions. And our guest this morning in this part of Focus is Laurel Prussing. She's a Democratic candidate for Congress in the 15th Congressional District here in Illinois. She's running against the incumbent, Republican Tom Ewing. And we will try to ask some questions here and the number of things that I have in mind asking. But as I say, that really her purpose in being here, not so much so she can talk to me, but so she can talk with you. And if there is a particular issue that you are concerned about and you'd like to know what she thinks about it, this is your opportunity to pick up the telephone and call in and ask her directly. And the number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if you're outside of the direct dial area and it would be a long-distance call for you, you can use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And then, of course, for Champaign-Urbana folks, we're here locally where we are, 333-WILL or 9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's my pleasure.
There are a number of things that we can talk about. Perhaps let me ask you a little bit about campaign finance just to start off with, because I know that it's something that that concerns you a lot and you have talked about a lot, the cost of campaigns and how they are financed. You have decided that yourself you're not going to take PAC money and going to limit contributions. Would you like to see public financing of campaigns?
Yes, I think there should be an alternative to the current system, and a number of states that have enacted campaign finance reform have given a public financing alternative. It's not saying that a millionaire who wants to, you know, try to buy an election should be prohibited from doing that, because we do have a Supreme Court ruling which sort of says that money is equivalent to speech, which I happen to disagree with. But what I'd like to see in Illinois is public financing for candidates who agree to limit their spending and to abide by the Illinois Code of Fair Campaign Practices. I think we've got a very serious problem when people can't run for office. Paul Simon said he couldn't run for a United States Senate because he didn't want to invest the time raising what he thought was the necessary amount, $12 million. And when you have sitting United States senators and congressmen spending time on the phone every day raising money for their next campaign, I think that shows there's something seriously wrong.
Mm-hmm. Campaign finance has been discussed in Washington, and we know that now nothing else is going to happen this session. I'm sure that somebody will raise it again. But it seems that members of Congress, many of them, aren't interested in changing the system. And what I wonder is, were you to be elected, what would you, as one member of the House, be able to do to make things any different?
Well, first of all, I do think a majority in Congress wants to change the system. Campaign finance reform passed the United States House. The congressman from this district, Mr. Ewing, voted against it. He voted in favor of raising the individual limits from $1,000 to $3,000, and that was one of the so-called poison pill amendments that was put on the bill. But his amendment was defeated. A majority in the Senate wanted to change it, but it was the leadership that established, I think it was a 60% majority to get the job done. What would I do if elected? Well, I'm not waiting to be elected. I'm actually doing campaign finance reform now. I think that some candidates just have to say enough is enough. There are 435 members of the United States House. Only eight of them refuse PAC money. And one of those eight is, of course, Glenn Pichard, and he's been doing this for 10 years. And whatever you agree with him on issues, particular issues or not, I think he certainly should be admired for his stand on PAC money. So I'm not taking PAC money. I set a limit on my spending. I challenged the incumbent to limit his spending to 2 or 3 times that amount, and he refused. So what I can tell you is if I am elected to this position, I will not make any promises to change the world. I will just try to represent this district better than it has been represented, and I will vote to support alternatives such as public financing with limits on spending and some kind of way of addressing the very misleading television ads that are characterizing campaigns.
What do you think about the idea of term limits?
Well, term limits is not a new idea. When the United States, when the colonies broke away from England and we had the Articles of Confederation, we tried term limits. The governor of Massachusetts was limited to a 1-year term. And when the Constitution was discussed in Philadelphia in 1787, term limits were discussed and they were rejected because it was felt that the public ought to have a choice on who they're going to elect. And I think that the idea that someone new is always going to be better than somebody who's been in there is a fallacy. And people ought to be judged on their record. And I think that if someone wants to run, they should run on their record. And we really do have term limits. We've got limits on the amount of time and someone has to run for re-election. And what's made it be difficult to challenge an incumbent is campaign financing, because all the PAC money tends to go to incumbents. Incumbents have tremendous advantages. They can send out highly political things on the franking privilege. The congressman from this district even sent out a fundraising letter on his congressional letterhead, which is unethical and illegal, but he did it nevertheless.
Our guest this morning is Laurel Pressing. She's a Democratic candidate for Congress in Illinois' 15th district. We try to do as many of these kinds of shows as possible to give you an opportunity to ask questions of candidates. And we have somebody here ready to go, and others would be welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And our first caller is in Urbana, and it's line number 1.
Good
Hello?
Morning,
yes.
Ms. Pressing.
Good morning.
I was wondering, I know there are some vast, vast differences between you and your opponent on environmental issues, and I'm hoping that you can outline some of those differences for us today, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, I really got my start in politics in the environmental movement. I was in an organization called Housewives Interested in Pollution Solutions, which started in Champaign-Urbana, and we got recycling started in this county in the early 1970s. I had the highest rating in the legislature of any downstate legislator on environmental questions. And Mr. Ewing has a very different kind of record. At one point, he had a 0 from the League of Conservation Voters. He voted to weaken the Clean Water Act. And one of my themes in the campaign is clean elections and clean water. And the connection is mega hog farms. These are giant industrial hog farms that got their start in North Carolina, with political contributions that paved the way to change the laws of that state. And this has been documented by the North Carolina Observer. They got a Pulitzer Prize for it. The first thing that the industry did was eliminate the requirement for local zoning. And after that, they were able to build these huge hog farms. They have a history of polluting the water, the groundwater. And there's one being built in Utah, which is going to generate more sewage than the city of Los Angeles, yet there is no requirement to treat that waste. So the North Carolina Observer, when they did a series of articles on this, they got quite a public response. I listened to the reporter who did the stories, and he gave a talk in Peoria a few months ago, and he said that on a normal story where they get a big response, they would get maybe 10 phone calls. And on this story, on the hog farms, they got hundreds of phone calls. And the one that he related that he remembered the most was a gentleman who called and said, I want you to come out and see, tell me what color my pickup truck is. And the reporter said, well, I'm sure I can do that. And the man said, well, I don't think you can. It's covered with flies. I talked with a woman in Livingston County, which is in the 15th Congressional District, and her family came out of their house one morning to a loud buzzing sound. They turned around and looked at their house, and their house was covered with flies. And they live about a mile from a mega hog farm. So the thing that people are concerned about who are neighbors is usually the stench and the flies, but really the long-term health problems are from water pollution and the fact that we're putting thousands of animals together in a building and dosing them with antibiotics, and we don't really know what the long-term outcome of that is going to be. The biggest health epidemic in the world was the 1918 influenza epidemic. My grandmother, my father's mother, died in that. My mother lost three younger brothers to that epidemic, and that virus came from American pigs. So I think that we're sort of waging biological warfare on ourselves. By doing these huge changes in the way we're raising animals without really knowing what the long-term effects are. And the Catholic Church has come out against these mega hog farms from the standpoint of the danger to the environment, the fact that it has wiped out many small producers. Hundreds of thousands of small pork producers were wiped out in North Carolina. And then also their third point was the cruelty to the animals. Here's an animal that is raised in a building, can't even turn around during its short lifetime, and never gets to see the light of day.
This is an issue that it has certainly been discussed here in the state of Illinois, and there is some, I guess, some disagreement about what level of government should these very large-scale animal-raising operations, what level of government should regulate them? Should it be counties? Should there be one set of regulations for all of the state of Illinois? Should the federal government somehow be involved? I mean, where do you really think the authority to make rules about these operations should rest?
I don't think there's any dispute about where the authority should rest. There's a question of where should these things be located. And I think that the argument there is, should county boards have the power to zone? Should industrial hog farms be considered agriculture, or is that something completely different from normal agriculture, historically what we've known as agriculture? And I think clearly this is something different because it is a huge amount of waste that poses a threat to the water supply. And so I'm not saying that there should be regulations, different regulations at different levels of government on how they run the operation, but I think the location, there should be some input from local governments. I support that. And I think states need to regulate them. And I think where it becomes a question of waters crossing state boundaries, then there is a federal role to play under the Clean Water Act. And Senator Harkin, who's the senator from Iowa, had a study commissioned by the United States Senate on mega hog farms. The difference between Mr. Ewing and me on this is that Mr. Ewing has said there shouldn't be local control. He said everything's, you know, being done by the legislature now. And on your program, he said that I shouldn't even bring up this topic. But to tell you what happens in a community where these things locate, in Iowa, where there are now more pigs than people, it has become the main political concern in that state. It ranks above crime and abortion. And in McLean County and in DeWitt County in the 15th Congressional District, people who live around mega hog farms have had their property values reduced by one-third by the local assessors. And so that means what this industry is doing is they are making money by shifting their costs onto the neighbors and onto future generations if we contaminate the water supply of this country.
Let's go again to another caller. This is also Urbana, line number one again.
Ms. Persing, what would you do, or what would you like to see the federal government do about the nation's drug problem?
Well, we don't seem to be very successful with what we're doing now, and I think we should look to see what other countries are doing, what works and what doesn't work. I think one obvious thing to say is that we need to devote more to prevention of the problem. And there are people, most of our jails are filled with people who have some kind of a substance abuse problem, whether it's alcohol or illegal drugs. And if these people want to get some kind of treatment, there is there are waiting lists that take months to go through. So we are not dealing with treating people who are addicts in a very productive way. We're putting all the resources into trying to keep drugs from getting through our borders, and that doesn't seem to work. So I think we should be looking at some alternatives, and we should look beyond our borders. What are other countries doing? And I think European countries seem to have a better track record. And our drug problem is the main source of our crime problem.
Are you in favor of repealing the disparity between powdered cocaine and crack cocaine?
I'm not really an expert on that. I could just talk to you in general terms that I think that what we're doing now is very expensive and very ineffective.
Okay, thank you.
All right. But you would not be one of those people who would say that we ought to decriminalize drug use?
I think that we should study whether we should decriminalize some sorts of thing and maybe make it be something that gets you into treatment instead of into jail, depending on what you're doing. If you're selling drugs to other people, I think that's a pretty serious offense. But we have a higher proportion of our population in jail than any other country in the world, and I think that should be a clear signal that maybe we ought to start looking at alternatives.
Our guest this morning, Democratic candidate for Congress, Laurel Prussing. She's running here in the 15th District in Illinois. And if you'd like to talk with her, you can call in. The number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line so that if it would be a long-distance call for you, you can use that number and we'll pay for the call. And that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. One issue that we've been talking a little bit about on this program, trying to at least promote some discussion of, it probably won't be an issue so much this time around, but I think a lot of people expect it's going to be a big issue next time we elect a president, and that is Social Security and the future of Social Security. And there are a lot of people talking about some kind of privatization. There are individuals who say that what we really ought to do is start slowly and start working people out of the system. People who now expect to receive benefits should get those benefits, but when newer workers come online, we ought to start slowly moving them out of Social Security and then into some kind of private investment. The goal being, I think, in some people's minds, that eventually there would be no more Social Security. And they think that that will answer this question, will Social Security be around in the future to pay benefits? What do you think we should be doing with Social Security? Should we change that system at all?
Well, Social Security was enacted in this country because of the Great Depression. Germany instituted social programs like this in the 19th century, but Americans were very resistant to it. And before the Depression, even the AFL and the CIO, which were two separate organizations at that point, I think it was the CIO. One of them came out against Social Security. Americans were very leery of socialism. And we got it passed in the Great Depression. Now Social Security is really the reason it looks like we don't have a national deficit, because the Social Security fund is being used to sort of mask the fact that we do have an operating deficit at the federal government level. The people who are talking about privatizing Social Security are ignoring the reason that we got into it in the first place, which was because of the failure of private markets. That's what the Great Depression was. And do we want to substitute social insecurity? Is that what we're trying to do? I mean, stock markets go up and stock markets go down, and I think everyone ought to have some kind of a savings plan, and you know, that's fine for them to invest in stocks, but that's not what the purpose of Social Security is. That's to provide a very basic floor, and I think that Americans should preserve the Social Security system, and I do not think that privatizing it is a reasonable thing to do.
The concern is that as the number of retirees continues to grow, people who will be receiving benefits, that then the number of workers, the people who are paying in to the system, and that's where the money comes from to pay the benefits. The number of retirees is growing, the number of workers is shrinking, and at one point it'll get to the point where there's just not going to be enough people paying into the system to pay the benefits. Now, of course, the government says they have this commitment to paying the benefits, so it's not so much an issue of paying them or not paying them. It's just a matter of where you're going to come up with the money. Do you think that that we need to do anything in terms of changing the system, like people who pay in are going to have to pay in more? We're going to have to put off the age at which you can start receiving benefits. Will there have to be some sort of means testing so that your benefit may, in fact, be determined by whether or not you really need it?
Well, I think certainly everyone should get back what they put in, and maybe with some sort of reasonable interest on that money. Maybe we can consider that someone who has an income that is 10 times the average might just get what they put in plus interest and then not get anything after that. But I think there are many ways that we can deal with the system. One of the problems is that not only do we have fewer younger workers relative to the retired population, but we can say it's a problem. People are living longer. I happen to think that's good that people are living longer. But people are allowed to work more now. Because we are living longer, we've loosened up some of the rules on how much you can earn before your Social Security is diminished. And I think the real problem is, how are we going to have good paying jobs in this country? Because that's what's financing Social Security now. One thing that I would do would be to raise the limits on when you stop paying in. I don't know what the level is now, maybe $65,000 or something like that. So you get the chief executive officer of a huge mega corporation who gets maybe paid in stock options, and they don't pay into Social Security. And then when they downsize the corporation and fire thousands of employees, then you have fewer people paying into Social Security. So I think we have to look at that. But as I say, the real long-term problem is, what are we going to do about jobs in this country? We've had federal programs, incentives for American corporations to locate overseas. They take good-paying American jobs and put them in some other country, and then we are left with many low-paying service jobs. And that is a harm to our social fabric, and it certainly is something that contributes to the financial problems of Social Security.
We have some other callers to talk with.
Hi, Laurel. I was wondering if you had a stance on same-sex marriages, whether you believe they should be legalized or not. Thank you.
Well, as I said at Illinois Wesleyan University, and I've been misquoted by the Ewing campaign, I don't think that this country is ready for what would be called same-sex marriage. And there are companies that are dealing with what they call domestic partnerships. And I certainly think that all people should have equal rights. There are discrimination against certain groups of people, and I don't think that we should be doing that. But as I said, I don't think the country is ready for what you would call marriage, but I think that having something called a domestic partnership might be reasonable, because homosexual people are human beings, and if they want to have a long-term relationship with someone and they want to have the right to visit that person in the hospital or whatever, I think they should have those rights.
What, can you talk a little bit more about just what sort of rights you're talking about, and how if that relationship is not sort of established in law, then what sort of ground does a person stand on when they say that indeed this is a long-term commitment, we have this relationship, and I should have certain sorts of
I think
rights.
that domestic partnerships are in law in some cities. And then, of course, we've had private corporations that have enacted it as part of their personnel policies.
Okay. We'll go on to LaSalle County, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I would like to first say that I do agree with Ms. Pressing on the Social Security aspect, and that it's only fair that people that make big wages, way over $100,000, $200,000, should pay in on all they earn, because the little guy who makes less than $20,000 pays on every dollar he earns, and it's a lot harder for him to pay in the percentage than it is the big guy. But the main reason for my call was to ask if she knows anything or any information on the disease Pfisteria caused by polluting of the streams. It's a neurological problem that causes memory loss. And have you heard of this?
That was one of the problems that they encountered in North Carolina.
Yes.
That the excess nitrogen from this animal waste was changing the quality of the water, and a normally benign organism, I think it's called Pfisteria, I probably am mispronouncing it. It's normally benign, but when this water was changed by the hog farms, this became a very malevolent little critter, and as you say, it attacked people, gave them nervous disorders, it attacked the fish. There was someone who wrote a book about it, that the fish were bleeding in the rivers, and something, I don't know if the title of the book is something about the rivers ran red or something like that, but that's what I'm talking about when I say we're waging biological warfare on ourselves. We are unleashing something in the environment that we don't really know what the long-term consequences are. And one of them is the use of antibiotics on these animals. We know from using pesticides that when you use pesticides, you just create tougher bugs. So whether it's tougher bacteria or some kind of weird kind of virus, or whether it's a little organism in the water that would be harmless naturally, but when you change and add so much nitrogen to the water, this becomes a vicious little thing that can attack human beings.
Well, you see, there's mega hog farms going up down near Winona now. And our LaSalle County Board, who is trying to get county zoning, doesn't have strength enough or nerve enough to stand up against them, and they put it off by saying they'll go by whatever the state standards are. Well, that proves to me that we don't need county zoning if they can't stand up to things like this. These hog farms are unnecessary. We don't have a shortage of pork in this country. The farmers can raise it on smaller scale, and it won't affect anyone, not even the odor, because it's not that extensive. So I hope that you're elected and you can do something about this.
Well, I would like to say that the LaSalle County Board should be congratulated for the vote that they took. They want local zoning control. I believe that's what their vote was about.
But they're not doing anything about the hog farm.
Well, they don't have the local zoning control. That's what the problem is. Illinois law exempts all agriculture from local zoning, and so far these giant mega hog farms have been characterized as agriculture, even though they really are more of an industrial activity than traditional agriculture. That's what the fight is about in Illinois. And Congressman Ewing has said that he's written to constituents and said that it's a local zoning issue, but in fact, that's what the whole crux of the problem is, that local zoning does not cover hog farms. And that's how the industry got started in North Carolina. It did cover local industrial hog farms, but they weakened the law to exclude themselves from it. And that's how we got the Pfisteria and all the other problems, literally ruining rivers in North Carolina. It got so bad that the North Carolina legislature enacted a moratorium.
Oh, they do have.
Yes, and Oklahoma has enacted some strict regulations. Jim Larkin, who's running for state representative in McLean County, has based his campaign on this whole issue. And the McLean County Board voted, I think it was 12-4, if I remember correctly, that they want local control. The Champaign County Board, however, voted that they don't want local control, and I think that's part of the problem we have with the county board in Champaign. But
well,
I think
in LaSalle County, they're trying to do away with the township zoning, and they're trying to override it. And to me, the township should have the right to zone hog farms out.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps we still will, because LaSalle County still doesn't have their zoning in place at this time.
Well, even if LaSalle County adopted zoning, as I said, the zoning law in Illinois now excludes mega hog farms, and the argument is whether they should be included, and I support including them, and Mr. Ewing opposes including them.
I see. Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thanks
Thank
for the
you.
Call.
Bye.
We have other folks here back locally here in Urbana. Next caller is on line number 2. Hello.
Hi. A couple of years ago, I called Representative Ewing's office to ask him to support the Federal Family Planning Program vote that was coming up. And his legislative aide, whom I spoke, told me that that wasn't possible because Mr. Ewing considered birth control to be the same thing as abortion. And I was just aghast because most reasonable people realize that birth control prevents abortions, and especially making it accessible to people who don't have coverage through their health care for the basic exam so they can get birth control. And it's only now that we're beginning to get some coverage for some people for even birth control pills. When I challenged Mr. Ewing about this when he was on the radio, I think this was about a year or so ago, or maybe it was two, he said that the aide was not speaking for him, but that birth control was too controversial a subject. And I'm still aghast at Mr. Ewing's stand, and I think that access to birth control is a very basic need in this country, and I'm wondering what your feeling is about this.
Well, I certainly do agree with you that it is a basic need. I think people ought to be able to plan their families, and I would agree with you that anyone who is opposed to abortion should certainly not be opposed to birth control, because that would prevent abortions. And so I think it is very hypocritical to take a stand and vote against family planning and yet say that you're against abortion.
Thanks.
All right. Again, another Urbana caller. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. First of all, I'd like to comment that Ameritech seems to be having a lot of problems with crossed wires here in Urbana. I've been getting a lot of cross conversation on my own phone here, so some of that may bleed through to the broadcast. But my comment is, or my question is, what's Ms. Pressing's attitude toward the effects of the NAFTA agreement, and what is her view, say, of fast-track negotiations?
Well, I think that part of the problem of our employment has been by these trade agreements. Theoretically, trade should be beneficial to both sides, but Japan, for example, has been able to protect its own industries and not allow American competition in the Japanese market while underpricing their products so that they can destroy entire industries in our country. And the same thing is happening with China. And I think if you're interested in this topic, there's an excellent book that was written by Richard, I think his name is Longworth. He's a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and I think it's called The Global Squeeze, something like that. It's about trade between the industrialized world and some of the developing nations. And he says, if you think you've got a problem with Japan, wait to see what's going to develop with China. We have a huge country. And Boeing, for example, the American aircraft manufacturer, has located plants in China. They're teaching the Chinese all the manufacturing methods, and they're going to be our competitors. If you go into a store now, you'll see many, many products made in China. And that means that American workers are being put in competition with workers who make a fraction of the minimum wage in America. And I think it's going to be a very difficult problem for us, because if we don't have good-paying jobs, that puts a tremendous stress on families. That means both the mother and the father have to be working, sometimes more than one job each. And I think it is a terrible problem for us, and I think that NAFTA has not proven to be what it was sold to be. And I think the reluctance to give this president fast-track authority is because of the problems that we're having with a never-balanced trade with Japan and a very great imbalance with China and with other countries.
Thank you.
All right. So this was, in fact, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, this fast-track. This would give the president the authority to work out trade deals. Then when they go to the Congress, basically the Congress can vote up or down but not put amendments onto it, as long as Congress is consulted in the negotiations. And this is something that has broken, does not, interestingly enough, does not really break down along partisan lines. There are Republicans and Democrats, some who are for it and some that are against it. Just this morning, I think we had a cut on our news from the governor, Mr. Edgar, who said that he thinks that it would be a good thing, particularly, I guess, I think he was talking about agricultural exports from Illinois. He would like to see it passed. But you would not vote to give the president that authority?
Well, you know, if you look and see, I'm a former county auditor, so I always, my advice to people is, first you got to read the law. What's this government supposed to be doing? What's the Congress supposed to be doing? Their responsibility is to deal with things like trade, and I don't think the Congress should sign it over to the president. I think the Congress should be involved, because we're talking about, we have standards for labor safety, worker safety, we have standards for the environment, and yet we're trading with people that don't have those standards, so naturally they can undersell us and kill our industries off. We used to be the leading manufacturer of machine tools, and that industry has been destroyed by competition from foreign countries. If it's legitimate competition, we're all working under the same rules, then I am for free trade, but I am not for undercutting American jobs.
Another caller, Bloomington, line four. Hello.
Hello. I was just wondering if you were aware of the fact that the thing that everybody's collecting right now, Beanie Babies, are made in China. They aren't made in the United States. The company is here, but the manufacturing is done in China.
I was not aware of that, and I am not collecting Beanie Babies.
But if you read the label.
Yeah. We've had a flood of imports from China. And I just wonder, what are we getting in return for this? I think we're undermining our own national security.
I think so, too. But I just thought, well, somebody pointed that out to me one day. Did you know they're made in China, not in Illinois or in the United States?
And does it say somewhere on there that they're made? Oh, so you can figure that out. If you look closely, you can see that.
So okay. Just thought you'd like to know that.
Okay.
Well, I walked into a discount store in Champaign, and everything that I picked up that was for children, clothing, toys, whatever, was made in China. Not one thing was made in the United States.
Hmm. Well, it seems like there are many product categories now where you cannot buy something. If, for example, you want to buy an athletic shoe, I don't think that you can buy one that's made in the United States. And it may, in fact, now be getting hard to find any shoe that's made in the United States. What when we talk about trade, I think we come down to this point again and again. People say they're really unhappy about the ease with which manufacturers in the United States can leave this country and go to other countries where the wages are much lower, and where in some cases environmental regulations are more lax, and it's cheaper for companies to have these products made or assembled outside the United States and then brought back here, and Americans, they're on store shelves here. But the question I think we always keep coming to, and there doesn't seem to be a very good answer for it, is what, if anything, government can do about that?
Government established this whole system. This is something that's under the influence of government. We can't control everything, certainly, but that's the point of Mr. Longworth's book, is that governments shouldn't be treating this as something that you can't do anything about. We signed agreements with Japan and with China, and we're not only allowing this to happen, we are providing tax incentives to American companies to do this. And that's where you see the connection between campaign finance and the kind of laws that we're getting. Big contributors, big corporate contributors, have had an undue influence on the laws of this country. And we're, as a result, we're creating a disaster for the future. We talk about, you know, what are the threats to this country? I don't think it's outside military threats that are as big as the internal threat of just sort of giving away the store, allowing unfair competition to wipe out American jobs, and using taxpayer monies to subsidize that process. I think that is wrong.
Well, give me an example of a case where there has been a subsidy that has gone to a company that has relocated jobs outside the United States.
Well, certainly McDonald's Corporation is subsidized in selling chicken McNuggets in France. I don't know if they're a big seller in France or not, but there's no reason for the taxpayers to be subsidizing a highly profitable corporation to do its marketing overseas. The fact that Boeing has located plants in China is something that was done with the American government's approval. And the fact that we have India exploding nuclear devices and Iraq has biological weapons, those were all from American technology. That was all done with the approval of the American government. And with, you know, we don't need any enemies if that's how we're going to treat ourselves, because we're the problem.
We'll keep going here. We'll get some other callers in. Urbana, line two, next. Hello.
Is it line two?
Yes.
Hi. I was wondering if you could tell me what your opinion is of the present levels of immigration and how that may affect the problems that one associates with high density of populations and scarce resources and so forth. I'll hang up. Thank you.
Well, this is a nation of immigrants, and I know that Mr. Ewing has said that they're the people that are filling our jails. I don't agree with that position. I think that you look at Social Security, we have an aging population. We have a shortage of young workers. I think that, you know, if our birth rate is going down, that one way to get able workers is certainly by immigration. So I am not someone who's going to bash immigrants. But it's always a tricky issue. How do you regulate immigration? Just as with illegal drugs, we don't seem to be able to close our borders to illegal immigrants, and it is a problem. And I don't think the answer is to say that we're not going to educate immigrant children. I don't think that's what we want to do. But there's some things that there just are not solutions to. There's not easy solutions to this. And I think immigration, like many other things, is a two-edged sword. I think we benefit tremendously from highly skilled immigrants. And I think people who have the energy to fight their way to get into this country are, you know, probably people that would be willing to work very hard. And that's what we would like to see.
Another caller here, Aurora, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I don't know. This is a question for Social Security. My mother got a bill recently, and I just was appalled by the prices that she got for the care she got. It was $60 for a bath, $110 for the nurse to come and visit, $136 for a social worker to come and visit, and I was appalled at the prices. I was just absolutely appalled, and I suppose this is one way of publicizing why and what is being done. Why is it $60 for a BAP?
Why is
the Social Security allowing that? I called the VNA, and I said to them, why are you charging that much? She kept repeating, well, Medicare says that's the price they'll pay. And I thought, but it isn't fair, I said to her. $60 for a bath, that takes maybe 45 minutes, maybe.
Well, who is charging the $60?
VNA.
I mean, what is that, a nursing home or
visiting
what?
The Visiting Nurses Association.
Oh, Visiting Nurses Association. Well, I'd have to go to them and you know, find out how they're deriving that price. I don't know what's included in it. It certainly sounds very high.
Well, it is. I mean, it's atrocious. When a doctor gets, what, maybe $60 to $70, $80, $90 for a visit, and when you go to him, and $110 for a nurse to come, I think it's terrible. And I let them know, but I don't know what I can do about it. And I just think it's atrocious. But that's the way our money's being spent. And I agree with China. I've stopped trying to find things that aren't bought in China to buy in America. You just can't anymore. I think the saddest thing is the people that this is affecting the most have no say-so in government. It's the people that work at these menial jobs that mean the most to them, and it's their livelihood, and they have no say-so in government, and they cannot fight for these jobs. Thank you.
I agree with you. Unfortunately, some of the people that are hardest hit by this, maybe they are just so overwhelmed by trying to make ends meet that they don't see the political connection. But if everyone got organized and voted in their own interest, then I think we could change this. But right now, politics is being dominated by money, very misleading television ads, and it's driving down voter participation. And the people that tend to stay home and not vote, as you say, are the people who are most affected by some of these trade agreements.
What do you do about misleading television ads? Do you have a review committee, someone who would look at the ads first of all and evaluate the claims and say, are they true or not?
Other countries apparently don't have the kind of freewheeling political ads that we do. I think you should let people say whatever they want, but then there should be an answer to it. And if someone is running a misleading ad, then the punishment should be that it's publicized. What you saw in the race for United States Senate on the Republican side was Peter Fitzgerald running a television ad showing a lavish office and saying that Lolita Diedrichsen had spent all kinds of money to remodel that office. The Chicago Tribune revealed on a front page story that the picture was not Diedrichsen's office. Now, I think that is fraud on Fitzgerald's part. But apparently many more people saw the television ads because he had so much money than saw the front page story in the biggest newspaper in Illinois. And I think the media has some kind of responsibility for monitoring the ads and making news stories out of false and misleading advertising.
We are at the point we're going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say, because we're here at the end of the time. We have a caller we cannot take, but we hope that at least once more between now and the election, we can do this program again. And we will also have other candidates on as well, so you can do the same thing. But for right now, we want to say to Laura Prussing, excuse me, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
Laura Prussing is a Democratic candidate for Congress in the 15th District here in Illinois.